In the early 1980s, when scientists learned how to modify the genes of plants in the laboratory, the business of agriculture changed dramatically and fast. Today, the science of seeds. This is a special joint broadcast of Iowa Public Radio and KCUR in Kansas City, in conjunction with Harvest Public Media. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to explore the history of biotechnology, or genetically modified organisms. We'll try to understand the science behind this technology, and more importantly, how it has impacted farmers and consumers worldwide. We'll also talk about safety concerns with GMOs. Join our conversation after the news. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we also welcome the listeners of KCUR in Kansas City for a special joint broadcast in conjunction with Harvest Public Media. This hour, we'll be exploring the science of seeds. I'll talk with Dr. Gurdev Kush, member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and 1996 World Food Prize laureate. We'll talk about his work developing new strains of rice and how he's seen GMOs change the lives of farmers and consumers. Then I'll talk with Doug Gurian-Sherman, senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Kendall Lamke, chair of agronomy at Iowa State University. We'll talk about safety concerns and other issues with GMOs. But first, let's go back to the beginning. Khan Wong is a professor of agronomy and the director of the Plant Transformation Facility at Iowa State University. She's here to help us understand this science and how it came about. Khan, humans have been breeding plants to have desirable genetic traits for thousands of years. What's different about what we call genetic modification?
I think basically it's a process of making this happen. So typically genetic modification is a result of biotechnology or recombinant DNA technology generated modified plant.
Okay, and when did the idea that we could do this in a laboratory, when did that first come about?
I really don't know, but I have my opinion. So it started 100 years ago about a plant disease called Crown-Gall disease. So the symptom is that plant will produce unorganized tissue called Crown-Gall, or sometimes people call it tumor. And sometimes it's a weak growth, sometimes it's a low yield, and a lot of time it's a death.
So these plants are having tumors or growths that are causing them to not produce as much as we would want.
That's correct. So around the 1901, USDA scientists recognized that disease is caused by a soil bacteria. And then they give that name as agrobacterial tumefaciens. So literally, it is agriculture-related bacteria that causes tumors, tumefaciens. During 1940s, scientists recognized that those bacteria are quite different from other typical bacteria. Normally, the disease symptoms associated with the presence of bacteria. When you remove bacteria using antibiotics or other method, the disease symptom will reduce or disappear. That we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
But not with this agrobacterium. In this case, even you completely remove agrobacteria from the infected tissue or plant, the disease symptom or the tumorous growth will remain. So this observation provides a clue that agrobacterium has made a permanent change in the infected plants. But what happened? How did it happen? Right? That's a very curious question to scientists in 1940s. And remember that time, and we did not know there was something called DNA yet.
Right. DNA had not been uncovered at that point.
Right. 30 years later, in 1970s, scientists used newly available tools and equipment. They were able to discover that during this infection process, the agrobacterium would deliver a piece of its own DNA into plant cells and insert this piece of DNA into plant genome.
So instead of the plant breeding with other plants and the genes deciding how this plant would look, there was actually a gene passed from the bacteria into the plant that changed how the plant grew.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, so scientists way back in the 1940s realized that this was going on. It took a long time for them to figure out what was actually happening, and then a little longer to figure out how to harness this power, because clearly I'm sure that the wheels began to turn right away when scientists were thinking, wait a minute, what else can we make this plant do?
Right, right. This is a very unique case because this is the only case, the cross-kingdom DNA transfer. So it's a piece of DNA from a bacterial, the kingdom of prokaryotic, to plant, which is a eukaryotic kingdom. So it's a very unique and fascinating. So that's my take of how the genetic modification starts. But
well, and it seems to me that it very quickly became a practical tool that scientists could use. Because if you're talking about this really beginning to happen in laboratories in the 1980s, we began to see it in fields not that much later.
That's precisely right, because everybody realized the great potential of this tool. So immediately, all this modification, all this basic research was undertaken very actively around the world. And very soon, we were able to introduce genes, which potentially have ability to help us for the farming practice.
Can you give me an example of some of the traits that we have bred into corn or soybeans using these genetic modification tools?
The very first or the famous traits that we all know is the BT corn. BT gene is a piece of the DNA which encode for a protein, the protein which is toxic to a group of insects. One of those European corn is one of
corn
those
borers.
Corn borers is one of the target. So that toxic protein is from a bacteria, again a bacteria. So scientists realize the relationship of that gene can and be used as insecticide, and they found out that they can insert into corn or other crop plant and then make those crop plants resistant to European corn borer.
One of the interesting things about what you've been saying is I know that a lot of people are concerned about genetically modified crops in the United States, and they believe that scientists are doing things that could not naturally take place if nature took its course. But that very first cross-kingdom DNA transfer that you described, that was a natural phenomenon?
That is a completely natural phenomenon, yes, indeed.
So the things that we're doing in laboratories now, how are they different from that first cross-kingdom DNA transfer that was observed?
I think it's a time. I think that a lot of those natural DNA transfer takes a long time and takes a long time to establish. And then the pace we are conducting in the laboratory is really hastened this process. That's something which can be scary.
When you experiment in the lab with transferring genes into corn plants or soybean, how long does it take from the beginnings of your experimentation to get it into something that will actually grow?
This depends on the experiment. And typically, the transformation experimentation carried out in lab as well as in the greenhouse situation is about 8 to 10 months from seed to seed. So you start off with some of the, say, for example, soybean seed. Then you incubate those soybean seed with agrobacteria. Those agrobacteria, of course, already have been modified to carry the gene of interest. Then you carry out this transformation in the lab, and then you go through a few months of incubation, selection, and regeneration. And then about 6 months later, they will be brought back to greenhouse again. And then a few months, like 2 to 3 months later, you get seed. And only difference is this type of seed carries your transgene, the gene of interest. So it's about 8 to 10 months, sometime a year, depends on the experiment.
It's a relatively short period of time from laboratory to field. And I want to look to the future because there is a technology on the horizon that could make things go even faster. Can you tell me about what's called TALEN, the transcription activator-like effectors nuclease?
So TALEN is a very powerful tool potentially for crop improvement. And there's a group of Iowa State plant scientists are currently working very actively on this project. So the technology is, again, it's from a bacteria. So essentially, this TALEN technology will allow us to precisely edit specific site of a genome or plant genome to make changes that will bring the new traits or beneficial traits to farmers and to consumers.
So you're actually editing the genome.
So genomic editing is a new term now that we use because we don't bring in any transgene anymore. We just understand the entire genome of a plant. And then next we want to know is, okay, which gene we can alter slightly to make it less disease susceptible.
These crops, with the way that we categorize or define genetically modified crops today, wouldn't necessarily qualify as genetically modified crops.
I don't believe it should be regulated as a GMO because there's no extra pieces going in.
And so this could do a lot to alleviate safety concerns.
This is exactly what we hoping any of a new variety we generate will be treated as a regular newly breed variety, only that we can be much more precise.
How far into the future do you think this technology is?
There is already a group in Iowa State demonstrate it can be done in rice. So it's a beautiful example already set up showing rice variety can become a more disease resistant through using this technology. And we want to make sure this technology can be applicable to the other major crops, corn and beans and sorghum and wheat and stuff. There's still technology challenging for us, but we are working, try to see it become more efficient. Once it's more efficient, and then it can be very easily applicable to seed industry as well as other research labs.
Khan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Khan Wong is a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. This hour, we're talking about seed science, and we're going to find out more about this technology and what's driving development of genetically modified crops. We're also going to talk about safety as the hour goes on. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With us this hour also are the listeners of KCUR in Kansas City for this special joint broadcast in conjunction with Harvest Public Media. This hour, we're exploring the science of seeds. And later in the hour, we'll talk about safety concerns and other issues with genetically modified crops. But first, with me is Gurdev Kush. He is a professor of soil science at the University of California, Davis. He's also a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and he is 1996 World Food Prize laureate. He received that prestigious award for his part in developing new strains of rice that literally have saved millions of people from hunger and even starvation. Gurdev Kush, thank you so much for being with me today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And you grew up on a wheat farm in northern India. What experiences did you have growing up that led you to study plant science?
You know, the yields in wheat farms at that time in North India were very poor, and so there was a lot of poverty. You know, farmers were not getting adequate income, so they had to work very hard to make their living, and there was all around suffering because of the low yields of wheat, which was the main crop. So I decided that I will go into the field where I could do something to improve the crops which feed the world, you know.
And, of course, Dr. Norman Borlaug transformed the production of wheat through his work, and I know that, that many of those crops were then grown in India. Did you watch his work and how it changed things?
You know, I was, at that time, I was studying in Punjab Agriculture University, and the breakthroughs in the wheat yields came when I was studying at University of California, Davis. When I was studying in Punjab, that Dr. Borlaug's breakthrough had not occurred. So when I came to University of California, that's when the first strains of high-yielding wheat came about, and they were very rapidly adopted.
You were then recruited by the International Rice Research Institute to work on developing new strains of rice, really to repeat in rice the work that Norman Borlaug had done in wheat. And working for the Rice Institute, you rose quickly to the head of the plant breeding department. What was driving you?
Well, again, you know, to do something for improving the agriculture and developing the crop varieties, particularly rice, because rice is as important as wheat. Actually, rice feeds half the world population. And so the center was established at Philippines to develop the technology to do something which could lead to breakthroughs in rice production. So I was very fortunate to be invited to work at International Rice Research Institute in Philippines. So it was a challenge which I took, and I applied all my efforts and my training to accomplish what Dr. Borlaug had accomplished in wheat.
How did you change rice?
You know, we modified the plant type of rice. For example, the old varieties of rice were very tall, 150 to 170 centimeter tall, and they were weak-stemmed. And at the time of maturity, when the heads became heavy, they fall over, they lodged. And once they are lodged, you know, they are damaged by rats, birds, and the yield actually goes down when the crop lodges. So the production of rice was very low with the old varieties. You could get hardly 2 to 2.5 tons from 1 hectare of rice crop. So we modified the plant type by reducing its height from 150, 170 centimeter to 100 centimeter. And also we selected the plants with dark green erect leaves, which can catch the solar radiation more efficiently, and the sturdy stems. So when you have a plant like that which doesn't lodge, you can add the nutrients, add more fertilizer, and the yields can be increased. So that was the main change in architecture, to make it more responsive to the added inputs. So one could get, instead of 2 or 3 tons per hectare, one could get 8 or 9 tons of rice from 1 hectare of the field.
Well, and you use the word modified when you talk about how you changed the architecture of the rice plant. And modified is a word that has become a little bit political in this conversation about crops today. But when you talk about the work that you did, you were using the old techniques through plant breeding, right?
Exactly. It was all conventional breeding. And so when we talk about modified, you know, it changing the plant architecture. But when we talk about genetically modified, that's entirely different, you know. But what we did was through changing the plant architecture through conventional methods.
You also bred plants that were more resistant to insects.
Exactly. Because rice is grown under tropical conditions, subtropical conditions, where the humidity is high, plants are then growing very healthy. When you add the fertilizer, they become more susceptible to the insects and diseases. So our next target was to introduce the genes for disease and insect resistance. So what we did, we looked at the old varieties which we had in our germplasm bank, screened those varieties, find out which are resistant. But those were poor yielders. So what we did, we transferred those genes for resistance into these high-yielding plant types which we had developed. So we had then the varieties which are high-yielding as well as resistant to diseases and insects. So that saved a lot of, solved a lot of problems. It saved the farmers a lot of money in investing the pesticides, and also it was good for the environment. You know, we could grow rice most of the time without using any insecticides.
Did you have any challenges making this stronger, more insect-resistant rice palatable?
No, we at the same time we were selecting for palatability because those are two independent things. Insect resistance and the grain palatability, they are inherited independently. So you can combine the genes for resistance as well as for palatability without much problem.
Now, as we mentioned before, doing this remarkable work, you were using plant breeding technologies that had been around for a long time, although you did refine them. In just a few years, just a couple of decades after this work, or even a decade after this work, suddenly it was possible to import a gene in the laboratory that could dramatically change how a crop operates. How do you feel about the work being done today with genetically modified crops, and how is it different than what you were doing?
Well, this genetic modification technology is, of course, entirely different. In the conventional methods, we work within the same species, like rice plants. There are a lot of diversity, different varieties, different species. So you can intercross them, transfer gene from one variety or one species into the other. So that's a process which has been going on for several decades, or actually for over a century. But in genetic modification, you bring a gene not from a related plant. You bring it from entirely different source, whether it's even bacteria or other plants which are not related to the plant we are trying to improve. So we have to isolate that gene through the various known techniques, and then introduce into the species like rice or wheat or corn where we need to introduce it. So that's an entirely different process. And this technology to transfer the genes from one organism into the other, unrelated organism into the other, that was developed only about 30 to 40 years ago, and the first genetically modified crop was released in 1996, only almost 15 years ago.
When you think about the work being done in laboratories today, do you have concerns about being able to manipulate the genes of plants in this way?
I don't have any concern because this work is very precise. When you make the crosses, for example, in conventional work, you bring in several genes in addition to the gene you are trying to bring in. In genetically modified program, you bring in a gene precisely what you want, and once it's introduced into the plant which we are trying to improve, it works normally, like any other gene which may have been brought by conventional methods. So it's very good technology to achieve something which could not be achieved through the conventional methods. So this is what it gives it an advantage, that you bring in a new trait which is not possible through the conventional breeding methods.
I'm talking with Gurdev Kush. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the 1996 World Food Prize laureate, one of the laureates that year. He received that award for his part in developing new strains of rice. And when you were doing that work with rice, clearly what was driving you was the need to feed people. There were people starving, and this rice made it possible to feed these people. What do you think is driving genetically modified crops today?
Well, you know, there are some problems which you cannot solve through conventional methods. For example, you take the case of corn. It is attacked by the European corn borer, and there are many losses. You know, it reduces the yield, and the plants which are attacked, the grain is not clean. So it's a serious problem, and there are not many genes which you could use to make it resistant. So with this new technology, a gene called BT from Bacillus thuriensis bacteria was introduced, and now the corn crop which has BT gene can be grown, and it's resistant to that insect, so that insect does not attack. Similarly, in rice, we have similar problems. We have an insect called stem borer, which attacks the rice plant, and we have introduced BT gene at International Rice Research Institute. My colleagues have introduced a gene, and this is highly resistant to the stem borer, but it has not been released for cultivation as yet. So this is another approach for increasing the productivity of these important crops further, you know, so that we can feed more and more people, you know.
There are a lot of people who are very concerned about the fact that the companies that produce these genetically modified seeds own the patents on these seeds. So the farmers who grow them can't save their seeds and plant that again. In fact, of course, this is an issue that is right now in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Does that worry you that farmers can't own these seeds?
No, it does not worry me at all. And I think there is a lot of misinformation which is spread by the people who are opposed to this beautiful technique called genetic engineering. If the companies produce some crop which is resistant, which is better than the conventional crop, farmers will buy it, and they buy it because it gives them benefit. It gives either higher yield or better quality. Only then they will they buy it. But nobody is forcing them to buy that modified or the crop which is patented. So the companies, when they develop that crop, they have invested a lot of money. It takes 10 years to develop a genetically modified plant. So they would naturally want to recover their investment, and they can do that through the patents. Now, if the farmers don't want to use that, nobody is forcing them. They can use their own seed saved from the conventional or non-GM crops. For just take a case of BT cotton in India. About 95% of the farmers now plant the BT cotton, which gives them a lot of advantage. But still, the non-BT cotton is available. So if the farmers don't want to, they can use the non-BT cotton. So nobody is forcing them. I think it's because they benefit from these genetically modified varieties, they use it.
But what about in developing countries where farmers may not have the resources to buy these seeds, but people are hungry?
No, you see, the difference in the price of the GM and non-GM crop varieties is not really that great. Only there are minor differences. So the poor farmers, they can also buy the seeds of the genetically modified varieties. It's not that they are not able to buy it. Actually, once they buy it, they will get more income. So they can use that income to buy it next year. You take the case of hybrid maize here, hybrid corn in the U.S. Every farmer buys it, although because they cannot plant the hybrid maize which they have, the seed they have bought, they have to buy every year. Why do they buy it every year? Because they get the benefit. So the farmers, whether they are poor or whether they are well off, they will buy it because they get the benefit.
Do you have any concerns about areas that we are not focusing on with this kind of research right now, because we are focused on profits and maximizing the yields for farmers? Are there things that we are not researching because of that?
I think there is a research going on the socio-economic impact of this technology, and the problem is that there are those people who are opposed to technology. They spread a lot of misinformation, and so, you know, the public has to be properly educated about this technology so that they don't have any concerns. There are, for example, there is misinformation that this will give you disease, this will not be good for your health, it will destroy your environment. So there is a lot of misinformation, and we scientists need to do more, and actually not only scientists, but our media need to do more to educate the public about the benefits of this technology, and so that our consumers have more faith in the
Gurdev Kush. We are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Sure. My pleasure.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today's program is in conjunction with Harvest Public Media and their series on seed science. You can find more information about that series on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. And we also are delighted to be talking with the listeners of KCUR in Kansas City today. Now we're going to move on to the most controversial part of this conversation. We're going to talk about genetically modified crops and their safety. With me is Doug Gurian-Sherman, senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Professor Kendall Lamke, chair of agronomy at Iowa State University. And we welcome your questions as well. You can join us at 866-780-9100. And I know that this is a subject that a lot of people feel very strongly about. We want to learn in this conversation, so we do ask that you keep your comments respectful. And hello, Doug Gurian-Sherman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And there's no question that GMOs have increased yields in all kinds of different crops around the world. There's no question that lives have been saved because of more plentiful food. No question that many farmers have made more money from growing these crops. What are the questions about GMOs that are of most concern to you?
Well, I'd have to challenge to some extent or qualify a couple of the statements you just made. There have been yield benefits, but I think it's important to understand that depending where what part of the world you're talking about, those yield benefits have generally been quite modest or small, and I think much smaller than we continue to achieve through conventional breeding and improved agronomy. So there have even been recent studies, but work that I did several years ago where we looked pretty comprehensively at the available peer-reviewed data on yield for the traits available in corn and soybeans in the U.S. at the time. And more recent work, just a paper just published in Nature Biotechnology, recent publications in American Journal of Economics that confirm what we found, which is that there are some yield benefits, but they're very modest, and there may even be some yield drag on some of the what we call stack traits when they combine several different traits. So,
okay, but that's not the argument that we hear, and I'm sure that can be argued as well. But
kind of stated it as a bold
move. I apologize for that.
Clear.
But what you feel are the more pressing concerns about GMOs?
Well, I think that, you know, the biggest concerns that we have is that we have huge challenges in agriculture. So, you know, the plus side, especially in the U.S., our agriculture is tremendously productive. That's great. But we also know that, including through the Green Revolution crops, that the higher inputs that that these crops require to be productive cause huge environmental problems. And so we see the big risks around any agricultural technology, including genetic engineering, is how well it it has and can address the challenges that we have. So, for example, we use, I think, about 6 times more globally nitrogen fertilizer. It was through chemical processes made much cheaper to use, starting actually decades ago, but especially in the 1960s, this use went up tremendously. So now we have probably about 400 dead zones in coastal waters around the world. The Gulf of Mexico dead zone, which is about 20,000 square kilometers per year, is one that people are aware of. In my neck of the woods, we have the Chesapeake Bay, which was once one of the most productive estuaries in the world, greatly reduced in its fisheries capacities because it also has a dead zone and greatly reduced water quality. And nitrogen and to some extent phosphorus water pollution that goes along with our productive agriculture is causing this. Agriculture contributes tremendously to climate change, and it uses huge amounts of fresh water, 70% or more of the extracted fresh water, and as population increases and climate change continues, that's going to become even more of a problem. So these are the, and people often talk about the risks of genetic engineering, which I think are worth talking about in terms of, is it going to hurt us if we eat it or hurt the environment, and it's, I think worth talking about that too. But I think, these bigger challenges of agriculture and whether genetic engineering or other methods can address them is really the biggest problem. And what our research and others, I think, have shown so far is that current genetic engineering is really just reinforcing the current system. It's not improving it dramatically. There's small reductions in chemical insecticide use, which are good. These are probably being eroded because now rootworm, one of the main target pests, is developing resistance and may lead to increased insecticide use. We have huge problems, an epidemic of resistant weeds because of the use of genetic engineering technology, which makes life easier for farmers in terms of weed control, but has exacerbated resistant weed issues so that recent reports suggest there may be 50 or 60 million acres infested now. It's going up dramatically. That's boosted herbicide use dramatically. And while some argue, well, that's not a big deal because the herbicide Roundup is not particularly harmful, the solution of the genetic engineering industry is to introduce a next generation of crops resistant to old herbicides like 2,4-D that were developed in the 40s, which can have tremendous problems in terms of drift, killing off native vegetation and so on. And there is quite a bit of epidemiological data that at least links it, although not conclusively, to diseases in farmers like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and
okay.
farm workers.
So, all right, Doug, so what you are telling us is that insect resistance and resistance weeds are your greatest concerns with genetically modified crops. And I want to bring into the conversation now the chair of agronomy at Iowa State University, Professor Kendall Lamke. Hello, Kendall.
Good morning.
And you sat on a panel with the National Academy of Sciences looking at the environmental impacts of biotechnology, of GMOs. What did you learn from that experience that speaks to Doug's concerns?
Well, yeah, so Doug covered a lot of turf, and so I'll have to try to piece this back together. So I tell the story a little differently, but what I learned by sitting on that NRC panel was I changed my mind about transgenics in general, and I don't think the technology itself, there's nothing evil about the technology itself.
And you say you changed your mind. Did you go in feeling that there was something?
Yeah, I was trepid. As a conventional plant breeder, and I'm still a conventional plant breeder, it was one of those things where we just didn't think that technology could add anything to plant breeding. And there's still arguments both ways on that. But the technology itself's not specifically harmful. I mean, all technologies have trade-offs, right? I mean, no matter what they are. And I don't think genetic engineering is no different than that, than any of the other technologies that we've introduced in agriculture, say, for instance, the mold board plow. And so I changed my mind about that. And I think the focus really needs to be then on the products that the transgenes produce. And the benefits they're bringing society, if they're bringing benefits.
And what do you think those benefits are?
Well, the transgenes on the market right now, and so that's as Doug was going through the agricultural story. I mean, there's a lot of what he said I don't disagree with. And so there are challenges in agriculture that transgenes will not be able to solve. I mean, there's no question about it. As I look at what's going on just here in Iowa, for example, I mean, a lot of the challenges we have with environmental issues in agriculture related to the cropping system specifically that we've transitioned to. And you could make the argument that, well, transgenes have enabled that cropping system to be maintained, but in reality, it's made it more profitable for farmers who haven't been given incentives by society to change the cropping system that they're using.
And when we talk about insect resistance and resistant weeds, those are side effects of GMOs. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I don't think they're side effects of GMOs. That's where I would disagree with Jug. I mean, so like the corn rootworm, I mean, corn rootworms evolve resistance to rotations. I mean, it's evolved resistance. You know, they've evolved extended diapause to get around rotations. And so that insect's been evolving very quickly before GMOs came on the market. And we've got resistance to other herbicides. In fact, there's resistance in Iowa to all the major classes of herbicides, and only one or two of them are controlled, have GMOs out there, Roundup mostly. But so we've been evolving resistance to herbicides and insecticides and other things out there for quite a while in agriculture. So that's nothing new. I don't think GMOs cause that, but how we've managed our cropping systems have certainly enabled it, and GMOs may have enabled it.
One of the big concerns that we hear people talking about, and Doug didn't really mention this before you mentioned it briefly, Kendall, but are GMOs safe to eat, and how do we know that? Kendall, what's your response to that?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to know that based upon the products we eat. So we eat a lot of proteins, and we eat a lot of protein. I mean, we don't know all the proteins that a plant makes, for example. At least I don't think we do. If we do know that, I'm not aware of us knowing that. And so we're just now understanding the genetic code of the plants that we're eating. And so we're eating proteins that we don't know about. We do know about these proteins, so we can, I think, get some feel whether there's any risk in eating the products of these transgenes that we're introducing into plants. And my personal feeling is that the ones on the market right now are perfectly safe. There are proteins that we can make in plants that wouldn't be safe to eat. And so, for example.
Are you concerned about people eating these crops, Doug?
Yeah, I think I pretty much share Kendall's perspective on the safety. I think there's many of these crops will be quite safe to eat. And for reasons that Kendall said, I mean, if you take a typical protein, there are, you know, many thousands of proteins in plants, and most of them are harmless. So if you kind of go by the odds, you know, a particular protein, you know, even coming from another organism, you know, may very well be harmless. But we do know, both based on principle, based on what can be produced in organisms outside of our food supply, as well as in our food supply, but we have a better history and understanding of those. But outside of our food supply, we know that organisms can produce all kinds of toxins that are made by enzymes, or that, you know, proteins themselves that could be allergens or harmful in other ways. And because we have no experience with them in our food supply, I think there is inherently a somewhat higher risk, you know, from this technology. There are scientists who would disagree with that, but that is the concern that I have and that we have. One of the main concerns. And so the trick is, though, is having a regulatory system that can identify those applications of genetic engineering that are harmful. And that's where we think, you know, our current system is too weak and falls down in part because, especially at the FDA, it's a voluntary system. There's no detailed guidance for the industry about how to test, you know, for safety of these crops. And so it's largely left in the industry's hands. That's a historical quirk of the laws that were used to regulate these crops. And so exactly how we should regulate them to assure that they're safe, I think, is a challenging discussion. But I think we've unfortunately defaulted to a very weak system without having an adequate discussion of how it can be made more scientifically sound and also, you know, stronger. And so that's, you know, that we find, we feel is one of the, you know, fundamental problems. Not that the technology is going to, you know, produce one after another harmful crops, but that we're convinced that, you know, it can occasionally do so, and we don't think that the regulatory system is adequately protective. At EPA, we're probably the risk is somewhat higher because they regulate crop genes, transgenes that can have pesticidal properties. Some again, work in ways that may be perfectly harmless. But there,
well, Doug, let me let Kendall respond on the subject of regulation. Kendall?
Sure.
Yes, that's a tough one, the going through regulation. So there are days that I don't disagree with Doug on that we do need a system that identifies potentially harmful products of transgenes that could come to the market. On the other hand, I think you could take a look at the regulatory system and say that there's a lot of potential transgenes that could have tremendous benefit out there that haven't made it to the market yet. Because the regulatory system's long, is complex, and it's very expensive, and I think an unintended consequence of our system is that it's put the delivery of transgenes into a handful of companies that can afford to bring them to the market because it is so expensive. And it's pretty much taken public sector out of the whole gene discovery process from my perspective, because I think there are a lot of genes out there that could have impact on quality. I was having a conversation with some people before I came to the show this morning about this, ranging from, you know, phytic acid in corn to methionine, lysine, tryptophan. All those things could be modified transgenically, I'm pretty certain, and have been, I believe, but they'll never make it to the market because of lack of value.
Do you feel that this technology is fulfilling its promise, Kendall?
Well, I mean, I think it's been overpromised, and so, I think if you look at what's on the market, I mean, what's on the market commercially? We have insect resistance and we have herbicide tolerance, and those two things have had some, had their impacts. I think Doug's done a pretty good job of going through that. And but you know, the big yield increasing, I mean, herbicide tolerance has nothing to do with yield, but it has a lot to do with allowing farmers to manage acres more effectively. And that brings to mind my number one concern about transgenes in our current cropping system environment, and that's scale. I think this is something people forget about. I mean, like in Iowa, where we have 65% of our total land area devoted to two Roundup resistant crops, that scale causes these unintended consequences, or is at least, you know, is what's the word I'm looking for here? Contributes to it at least, because now we're spraying a lot more acres with Roundup than we ever have before. And
Doug, earlier when you were talking about the many issues in agriculture that you're concerned about, it sounds like you feel like this debate over GMOs is kind of obscuring some of the problems that you consider to be greater in agriculture today.
Well, I think that's partly true. I mean, I don't want to dismiss the environmental concerns or the human health concerns of the technology per se. You know, they have, I think, sometimes been exaggerated in the press, and sometimes I think downplayed too far. But yes, I mean, I think these other issues are tremendous issues that are not getting enough attention. And I think, you know, to Kendall's point about techniques and genes waiting in the wings, I think actually I have more confidence in conventional breeding and the genetic diversity that we've continued to discover in crops and their wild relatives. I guess they have more confidence in breeding right now than okay. Transgenics.
Doug, we are out of time. Doug Green-Sherman, yep. Senior Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you. Professor Kendall Lamke, Chair of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Jason Burns today. Thank you to the listeners of KCUR in Kansas City for joining us, and to Harvest Public Media. This is Talk of Iowa.